the month of Adar, or this year, the second month of Adar, is actually Thursday and Friday. So 2 weeks from Thursday is going to be Purim, the 14th day of the month of Adar. And it's really worthwhile to take some time to learn the story of Esther as an adult. Because when we learn it in school, we miss so much. First of all, because there's a heavy adult component to the story that you just don't want to play up for little kids, right? As a little kid in school, they don't tell you, yes, Vashti is likely dead, right? The first queen of Ahasuerus, the one who didn't listen to him, and so he magically in chapter 2 was looking for a new queen. They don't actually tell you that he executed her, but there's only one way to be an ex-queen in the Persian Empire. Or they tell you as a little kid all about the beauty pageant, right? Isn't it beautiful? They get all the women from all around the kingdom and they get to come to Persia's capital, Shushan. That's a grotesque, horrific thing. And when you read the story, like read it in the text, you realize what's going on. They tell you that each of these women has to spend a year preparing herself to go to Ahasuerus, and go to Ahasuerus, you know what that means. And then after that, she's consigned to the harem. Her public life is over. If she's chosen as queen, then she gets to be queen. If she's not chosen as queen, that's it. You're just part of, you're never going to have a life, a family, and everything else. You're part of Ahasuerus's, you know, palace. Not to mention, at one point in the text, it says that they were betulot, which should mean young women who have not been married before. But at another point, it talks about nashim, which are older women, women who may even be married. This is not, you know, a call for young women who are interested in becoming the queen potentially. This is taking people by force, and it includes women who are already married, and it's a grotesque, horrible thing. So I don't blame them for sparing school children from these parts of the story. But at the same time, it means that when you're an adult, you have to reread this, right? It gives you a completely different picture of what's going on. And you also miss the psychology of the story. There's so much going on psychologically. And there are so many challenging questions that the story is meant to trigger for us so that we'll understand it on a deeper level, that you have to relearn it as an adult. So that's what I'd like to do. And I want to start off with a passage which, once you have your source sheets, you will see it as the first source. I'm going to read it to you. It's a passage which talks about King Ahasuerus. You may well have heard this discussion that the Talmud has before. Tell me something. Ahasuerus, smart or foolish?
Oh, wild.
I heard bold, I heard foolish.
Wild.
Sorry?
Wily.
Wily. Interesting. What would give you the impression that Ahasuerus is wily? He has goals. He knows what he wants, or we think he knows what he wants. And he is going to strategize in order to get what he wants, eliminating Vashti, getting Esther. We're going to see more about that. Good. I heard a few people who say foolish. Why foolish? Yes, Eddie.
He lets someone groom whatever without
right. Haman, his second in command, he can do whatever he wants. I should tell you on the sheets once they're here. You'll see I gave you a summary of the story on the page in case, you know, a refresher is in order, which may well be. And I don't want to spend time reading the refresher, you know, aloud to the extent I can avoid it. But your story begins with a big party. As the story starts, Vayihi bimei Ahasuerus, it was in the days of Ahasuerus, who reigned from Hodu to Cush over 127 different lands. Keshevet HaMelech Ahasuerus al Kisei Malchuto, when he was on his throne, he made a huge party. Not really at the beginning of his reign, by the way. It's actually in year 3, something we may come back to. But he makes not one party, but two parties. First, he makes a six-month party, 180 days, to which he invites all of the dignitaries from all of his lands, which may be why it's a six-month party. Because can you imagine trying to get people traveling from far, right, coordinating their schedules? You can't just leave your land. Arrangements have to be made. So maybe that's why he needs to spend 6 months, right? This week those guys come in, this week those guys come in. Could be. But it's a six-month party followed by a one-week party for the people of the capital of Shushan. Well, that tells us a few things. First of all, this is a king who likes to drink. And in fact, the whole book, he's drinking. Like, that, he doesn't stop from the start of the book all the way to the end. This is somebody who is into his wine. But as part of that business of these parties, the Talmud has a fascinating debate. I'm glad we now have the sheets. And you can take a look at source number one. So the first sign has the summaries of chapters 1 to 7. Which you can read through quickly, if you like. And then the next side, you have the summary of chapter 8. There are two more chapters afterwards, 9 and 10, but in the interest of time and focus, I didn't discuss those. There's a lot to be said about them. But source number 1, which follows the summary, is about those parties that he threw. And the fact that at the end of the first party, if people can look up together, I think that may be necessary. At the end of the first party, he makes this second party with the people of Shushan. So look at this passage from the Talmud. At the conclusion of these days, meaning at the conclusion of the first party, Rav and Shmuel debated. Rav and Shmuel are sages from the time of the Talmud. You're talking 3rd century, Common Era. One said he was a wise king. The other said he was a foolish king. The one who said he was a wise king said he did well, drawing near the distant first. He could always appease the residents of his city. So first he makes a party for everybody from far away. And then he does a local party because the people of Shushan, the ones who live nearby, I can take care of them later. That's one philosophy. So he did the right thing. He was being smart. The one who said he was foolish said he should have drawn the residents of his city near first. For if the others would rebel, these would stand with him. Play to your base. Right? First you make sure you secure your base, and then you can entertain your foreign dignitaries. Two different schools of thought. One says he's wise, the other one says he is foolish. You hear both arguments, right? Okay. But the underlying message here is that Ahasuerosh is a schemer. He isn't just throwing parties. This isn't just about, I want a good time. There's a strategy. What is it that drives Ahasuerosh in his strategy? Whether you take the first view or the second view here in the Talmud, what is it that's motivating Ahasuerosh? Power? Vanity? I'm not seeing vanity in this source. Sorry. They're seeing something else here. Close, yeah. So he definitely wants to display his wealth. That's very clear. But he has a particular end game. What he's driven by here is fear. That's what this is all about. It's about security. The fear that somebody is going to take him down. And so, he's going to make a big party for all the dignitaries of the foreign lands to display his wealth, to display his power, that they should all respect him. And he's also making a party for the locals, because he needs them, the people of the capital. And the only debate is, did he do it right or did he do it wrong? Right? You could say, He's afraid, and therefore he he's pitching first to everybody else, knowing I can always take care of the locals. Or you can say that was foolish; he should have taken care of the locals first. But either way, what the Talmud is reading into Ahasuerus's actions is a man who is afraid, and that drives him to plot. It drives him to scheme. And we're going to see why the Talmud reads this in. You could read parties in a lot of different ways. You don't have to read parties this way. But you'll see that the book itself shows us that Ahasuerus is a man on the run. He is very afraid. And he may be good at scheming. He may be bad at scheming. But for sure, that's what's driving him. That's what we're going to see here. Now, there's a lot to be said about the book, obviously, in a greater sense. This is a book that hides God, right? Divine manipulation isn't there. For example, you may be familiar, God's name never appears in this book, which is very handy. You know, we have a rule in Judaism that you're not supposed to erase God's name. But every once in a while, for a flyer, a poster, a piece of art, you want to have some kind of like scroll with Bible-style text in the background of your artwork. But if God's name shows up and people can't erase it, they can't throw it out, it's a big pain. So what do? You take a piece from the Book of Esther, because you know you're never going to have a problem if God's name doesn't show up. So you can find something like a piece of Passover artwork that'll have the Book of Esther in the background. It's sort of like, if you've ever done this, but word processing programs that come with prepackaged text that's just gibberish Latin, lorem ipsum, whatever it is. That's what the Book of Esther does. But more relevant for us, the absence of God's name is explained in different ways by various commentators. But it's clear when you read the text itself that there is an intent to read everything that happens as it would have appeared to a Jew of that time. When you don't have prophecy anymore, this story is taking place between the first and second temple period. There are still prophets yet. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi have not yet finished their tasks. Nonetheless, this book, which is between the first and second temple period, or really, I shouldn't say that, the beginning of the second temple period would be more accurate. This is speaking to a population that doesn't have God's visible, miraculous hand, that needs to see human events and try to find God in them. And so the book plays out with humans doing human things, and then we read into it and say, okay, but that was really God doing it. And we'll see more of that as we go on. But let's see the book itself. Parakaleth, chapter 1. The Persians are the most powerful empire of their day. Indeed, the Talmud looks at it as the only empire of their day. They crushed the Babylonians. They crushed basically everybody else. There's some debate about Ahasuerus' identity in the line of the Persian kings. Was he Artaxerxes? Was he Cambyses II? But the bottom line is that Cyrus the Great, also known as Cyrus II, but I think he prefers Cyrus the Great, was the great unifier of the Persian Empire. He was the one who conquered the Babylonians, and he was the one who told the Jews, go back to your land now and build a temple. That's before the events of Purim. That's why I say that the events of Purim are early in the Second Temple period. Nonetheless, an awful lot of Jews didn't go back. Only 42,000 and change actually went back to build the temple. Mordechai, Esther, and all these others are living in Shushan, the Persian capital. They haven't gone back. Ahasuerus makes his big party in chapter 1. He summons Queen Vashti to be on display when, as the book puts it, Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin, which may be best translated as he is good and drunk. He wants Vashti brought out. Vashti says no, thank you, except minus the words thank you. And Ahasuerus is angry, and he consults his political advisors. And the advice he gets is remove her monarchy. Doesn't say she's dead, but we know she is. And to decree empire-wide, wives must listen to their husbands. That's chapter 1. Foolish king or wise king? What questions does this force us to ask? This chapter, what questions does it force us to ask?
Why did she refuse?
Why did she refuse? Okay.
Why was it important to remove her?
Why was it important to remove her? Not only that, but how did he remove her? Aside from killing her, but how did he go about this? Sorry?
He's being advised by his advisor.
He's being advised. He consults his political advisors. And he sends a letter throughout the entire kingdom. To whom are they concerned? This is your king speaking. I summoned my wife to show up at a party and she refused. So I got rid of her. From now on, wives should listen to their husbands. Sincerely yours, Ahasuerus. Does he not know how this looks? I mean, okay, side note. All resemblance of people in this story to anyone in power in any particular country today is entirely accidental. But, what is this man thinking? Why did this seem like a good idea? Take a look at your sheet. Take a look at source number 2. This is from the text. And the king said to the wise man regarding what to do about Queen Vashti, for she had not performed the word of King Ahasuerus to his officers. If it is good to the king, let the royal word go forth before him, and let it be recorded in the laws of Persia and Media without violation, that Vashti did not come before King Ahasuerus, and the king shall give her reign to her peer who is better than her. You have now broadcast your failure to the entire empire. You were embarrassed in front of whoever was hanging out at your party. Now you're embarrassed in front of the world. Why? What is this about? So, first of all, why did she refuse? Right? I mean, why doesn't she go out to the party? And then, why does he escalate things in this way? So, source number 3, the Talmud actually sees divine manipulation here. This wasn't random. God is moving the story along. He's setting things up. Take a look at number 3. Why didn't Vashti come? The Talmud asks. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina said, this teaches she broke out in Sarat. Sarat is a skin ailment of some kind. Often translated as leprosy, although that is not an accurate translation. But often it is understood to be a punishment from God for something. So what we're reading here is, Vashti has been bad in her own right, and the Talmud goes on at length to talk about her, but she's not our subject right now. But the point isn't punishment. The point is, God wants her not to show up. Because he wants her not to be queen, but instead, Esther to be queen. So she refuses to go. He consults his political advisors and sends a message through the empire. This is such a bizarre decision that the Talmud solves it by playing on a greater theme in general on the transition of power between the Babylonian Empire and the Persian Empire. And that is that Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, is not part of Cyrus's royal line. That's not how he became the king. He became the king by marrying a Babylonian princess. Vashti was the power of the family. Which may also be why she's not interested in coming out to the party. Who are you summoning me to show up at the party? Source number 4, the Talmud actually talks about how she made fun of him. King Belshazzar, the last leader of the Babylonian Empire, threw a big party the night before the Persians conquered the Babylonians. And he drank as described in the Book of Daniel. Some of you learned it with me not long ago at the Bethesda. He drinks with 1,000 officers. So Vashti
turns to her husband, Ahasuerus, or sends a message to him, saying what you see in number 4. The king was enraged. Why did her refusal so incite him? Rava, the sage of the Talmud, explains, she sent a message to him. Sable boy of my father. My father drank the equivalent of 1,000 others and did not become intoxicated. You've become foolish with your wine. Immediately his anger burned in him, and so on. But this isn't only a personal offense, right? You're not the man my father was. It's a political offense. Because she's reminding him of where the power lies.
And where it came from.
Exactly. I'm the royal one in this relationship. You are the pauper I married and turned into a prince, right? He's the frog. Right, to use the Disney theme. You're the frog, I kissed you and made you into a prince, but I can just as easily reverse it now. To which he says, off with her head. Because, you know, that also happens. But what you're seeing in chapter 1, what the Talmud is seeing, an amplifying force, but you can see it in the text itself, is this grotesquely insecure man who's holding his parties in order to keep his enemies, right, his friends close, his enemies closer, strategizing, whether successfully or not, whose wife refuses to show up at the party, and he is so upset that he's going to send a letter to the whole empire letting them know she didn't obey and now she's dead. Even though he's going to humiliate himself in the process, it's worth it to him because of his fear. Now watch what happens next. Because this is really remarkable. I have to say, over the years, I've put this together. Some of it is my own, and some of it comes from places that I've heard others say things, and I don't remember anymore how much of it is mine, how much of it belongs to others, so I apologize if I'm taking credit for others' ideas, but it's because at this point it's blended together in my mind. But chapters 2 and 3 are, so to speak, where the action is in this story. And I gave you the summary on the first slide, right? He goes looking for the girls who are going to audition. He is then going to commit what is more or less serial rape. That's what it is. There's no other term for it. With all of these women. Esther is taken to the king. She does not want to go. The word of the Megillah is Vati Lakach. She was taken. This wasn't a situation in which people said, yes, we want a campaign for this. She's brought to the king. She hides her Jewish identity, right, as Mordechai, her guardian, has commanded. Commanded. It's not worded as commanded there. Fine. As Mordechai has advised. Esther finds favor, she becomes the queen. Then you get an interlude at the end of chapter 2. Right, there's a plot on the life of Ahasuerus. Bigtan and Teresh, members of the palace, officers of some kind, are angry at Ahasuerus, and they plot against him. Mordechai finds out. He tells Esther, who tells the king. They are executed, and the event is chronicled in the Chronicles of Persia. The Persians were great chroniclers, if that's a word. They loved recording history. For that matter, the Babylonians and the Assyrians did a not bad job. The Assyrians did a great job of chronicling things. We have all sorts of records from them. We don't have records of our own much. Heard a talk from a historian who gave a fascinating explanation of why that is. I'm just trying to remember his name. His first name was Josh. But I'm blanking right now on his last name. Berman, professor from Bar-Ilan University in Israel. He pointed out all the empires of the East all wrote their records on clay. Right? They wrote their records on clay tablets. That's how they did it. We were using parchment. Which one's more durable? Not to mention, the enemy invades and they conquer and they light your library on fire. If your library includes parchment, it is gone. If your library is on clay, so all they did is fire in the kiln. Now it'll last forever. That's it. So we have tons and tons of records from the Assyrians and the Persians and all that. And we have very little of our own. Which is terribly sad, but that's just the way it is. In any case, going back here, they chronicle this event, and then we move into chapter 3. And Ahasuerus gives a man by the name of Haman absolute power. Everybody has to bow to Haman. Everybody has to obey Haman. And of course, Mordechai refuses to bow to Haman, getting him angry. And Haman sells Ahasuerus on a plan to eliminate the Jews. He says, these Jews are scattered. They don't listen to anybody. They're a threat. I'll pay you to do it. And Ahasuerus says, you can keep the change. I'm good. I don't need the money. Get rid of the Jews. And the rhymes go out to spread the word. This is such a strange story. First of all, why does Esther need to hide her identity? Why is that a good idea? Sorry?
Would you marry her?
Why not? What are Jews to him? Besides, you know, another land he conquered. There's no anti-Jewish sentiment until Haman comes along. Right? Remember, his predecessor, Cyrus, said that the Jews could go back and build their temple. There's a case to be made that maybe there's some hostility because the Samaritans, who are enemies back in the land, told the Persians bad things about the Jews. Maybe. But it's really unclear. As a kid, again, you hear this story, and you hear that Mordechai told Esther to hide her identity, and you think it's like wearing a baseball cap when you go to, on the subway, to avoid getting attacked. But that's not the case here. You're not dealing with an anti-Semitic environment, again, until Haman comes in, which hasn't happened yet. So, why exactly is this a good idea? That's number one. That's true, but what's this business about hiding her identity? How does it, in fact, help her? Take a look at source number 5. The beginning of chapter 3, Haman is given standing. After these matters, King Ahasuerus elevated Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Agag was a former king of Amalek, the classic enemy of the Jews, and raised him up. He raised up Haman, and he placed Haman's seat above all the officers who were with him, and all the king's servants in the royal gate would kneel and bow to Haman, for so the king had instructed for him. Did you notice the beginning of that passage in number 5? After these matters, in Hebrew, Achar HaDvarim HaEla, when a passage in the Torah begins, after this, then that happened, that tells you there's some kind of a connection. What immediately preceded this passage was the assassination attempt on Ahasuerus. There's a connection. Something is going on here. Something must have led to this. But here's another question. Haman. Who is Haman? Do we know anything about him before this moment in time? The book of Esther doesn't tell us a thing. We have no information about who Haman is. What kind of credentials do you think you need in order to become the one in charge of the entire empire who everybody has to answer to?
Ruthless.
Strong military man. Those are reasonable answers. We have no record whatsoever of who Haman was before this, biblically. Meaning, there is a Talmudic passage where they suggest one of the advisors listed earlier for Ahasuerus was named Memuchan, and maybe he was Haman. But there's another passage there in the Talmud that says, actually, no, that was Daniel. It's somebody else. It's hard to pin down who Haman was at all before this. Here's another question. I mentioned it before. Haman offers Ahasuerus a lot of money. 10,000 silver talents, which I gather is a lot of money. Right? But he says it sounds like it's a lot of money. And Ahasuerus says, HaKesef Natumah, the money's yours. Don't worry about it. This is a king who likes his wealth. This is a king who shows off his wealth. Why does he refuse the money? I mean, you're being offered it. Why did you say no, Ahasuerus? So here we get the guts of what's going on. First of all, who's Ahasuerus going to pick as the queen? We know the story. Esther. Sorry, you can ask. You got a question? No. He picks Esther. He picks Esther. Why? She's really attractive. That's what's described, right? If she finds favor in his eyes, the Talmud talks about God making her, you know, look particularly appealing to him. But let's ask the political question. You are a king who's very scared, right? You got rid of the previous queen because of fear. Why do you pick somebody who has nothing to offer you politically? She's no threat. Meaning, historically, kings made their marriages as political alliances, right? Think about Europe for hundreds of years, right? Or go back to the biblical times in Solomon. King Solomon marries women from all sorts of lands. He creates alliances. That's what he should be doing. But Ahasuerus is doing what people have always done, employers have always done, right? If you had a problem with an employee, then when you look for a replacement, you look for someone who doesn't have that problem. You're always fighting the last battle. His problem with Vashti was she had too much power and intimidated him. So now, he goes looking for somebody who's a nobody. It's a very smart strategy, not having her tell them where she's from. She's no threat. She has no base. Who are you? Where are you from? Nobody. Perfect. You got the job. That's it. It's a really remarkable strategy. This may even be hinted in source number 6. The Talmud comments. And Esther bore favor in the eyes of all who saw her. That's the text from the book of Esther. Rabbi Elazar said, this teaches, she appeared to each one as though she was from his nation. Everybody thinks that she could be them, on their side, because there's no other identity present. That's number one. That's how Esther lands the job. But number two, Haman. Haman is elevated, and we know nothing about who he is before. Now you start to wonder, why? What's the answer?
He's also no threat.
He has nothing. He's entirely dependent on Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus does not want anyone who has power independent of his own. So much so, the Talmud has this line in source number 7. We have learned Haman was the barber of Karkarzon for 22 years. He was a barber.
That's a good deal.
Yeah, exactly. Now, why do you do that for 22 years? You make a lot of friends, you know. But he's politically, he's a nothing. And he's given power over everybody because it's not really about him getting power, it's about Ahasuerus. He is Ahasuerus's man. That's what this is all about. And that's why the passage began after these things, after the assassination attempt, because that's what it was all about. Somebody within the palace, two people within the palace, plotted against the king. He doesn't know who he can trust. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take someone who has no connection to any network. He's the one in charge. Everybody answers to him. It's a direct outgrowth of the assassination attempt. This is a great novel. It's too bad it's already written.
Yeah.
However, this is also going to plant a seed of doubt. Because now that you gave someone this kind of power, what happens if he turns on me? Then what happens? So there's still going to be that germ. There's still going to be that doubt. Now, last piece of this section. Haman plays on the insecurity. Take a look at... Did I bring it here? Hang on. No, I didn't bring it on there. I thought I did. Okay, but I didn't. Ahasuerus is approached by Haman. Haman says to Ahasuerus, I want you to destroy the Jews. But he doesn't make the pitch based on Mordechai not bowing down. He says to him the following, Yeshnoam echad menuzaru meforad bein ha'amin v'chol medinot nachuzatha. There is a nation that is scattered among all the lands that are under your control, all the parts of your empire. V'datehem shonot v'koham. Their religion, their law, is different from what everybody else does. And they don't practice what the king practices. And it's not worth it to you to leave them be. It's about you. These Jews, they're different. Right, we've heard that one a lot. Take a look at source number 9, please. Number 8 is the Talmud commenting that the assassination attempt of Beitan and Teresh is instigated by God. God moving the story along, making Ahasuerus insecure. But take a look at source number 9 right now. When Haman says their law is different from that of any other nation, the Talmud says, what's he saying? They don't eat our food. They don't marry among us. They don't marry theirs to us. Jews are different. That's playing on the insecurity of Ahasuerus. And Ahasuerus is so convinced that he's going to bankroll it himself. Or, alternatively, his ego won't let him have somebody else fund it. I wonder if that's not what's going on. It's like, I don't need your money. Right? Your money's my money anyway, Haman. I'm gonna go ahead with this without your donation. But what you're seeing here, and what I hope is clear as we go through this story, is that Ahasuerus is a man driven by fear, which leads him to plot. It leads him to overreact to Vashti. It leads him to pick somebody who won't be a threat to him as queen. The fear is elevated by the assassination attempt, and it is manipulated by Haman, right, who he has elevated in response to that fear as a way to put somebody in a position who is loyal only to Ahasuerus and has no one who's loyal to him. That's where we are right now in a nutshell. And then you get to chapters 4 and 5. And Esther manipulates Ahasuerus. Chapter 4, Mordecai goes to Esther to help. He tells her there's a decree against the Jews. Esther says, I haven't been invited to the king in 30 days, and going to the king without an invitation can be fatal. Haven't been invited in 30 days. Either she's saying, I'll be invited soon, because it's been 30 days. Or she's saying, I can be out of favor with him. Mordecai says, look, God's always going to find a way, whether it's you or somebody else, which I have to say is not exactly the best pep talk. Fine, do what you want. There's more to be said about that, but not for right now. But Mordecai says, I don't know, could be, this is your time. She says, all right, I'm going to go. After a 3-day national fast. That's chapter 4. Beginning of chapter 5, Esther goes to the king. Ahasuerus likes her, says, I'm going to give you up to half the kingdom. What do you want? And Esther invites Ahasuerus and Haman to a party where she's going to make her request. And then at the party, she invites them to another party where she's going to really make her request, whatever it is that she wants. Haman's feeling pretty good until, of course, he sees Mordecai. Mordecai is bowing to him, and he's angry, and he comes home, and his friends say, you should have a royal execution. Have the king kill Mordecai. Haman could have done it on his own. Right? Haman is in charge of the kingdom. He doesn't need to make it royal. He wants it to be royal. That's the idea. So that's chapter 5. So let me ask you a question first. Is it smart to run a kingdom where the only people who are admitted to the king's presence are the ones he's invited? Right? I mean, it's a good way to make sure that people around you all say yes to you. Right? But it's a very bad way to govern. You're not going to get anywhere. Even Haman, right, lurks outside the palace when he wants to contact Ahasuerus. Then we'll see that in chapter 6. This is a neurotic king. He's so scared that you can't get in without the invitation. And you see it when he says to Esther, what do you want? I'll give you up to half the kingdom. What kind of affectionate statement is that? I'll give you whatever you want up to half. I just want to make sure I retain voting rights. Right? That's what it is. I just want to make sure I get 51%. Other than that, whatever you like. But Esther's smart. She takes advantage. What did she do here that's going to play on his insecurity? Sorry, someone said it. She invites Haman to the party. You ever wonder about that? Why are you inviting Haman to the party? Haman is your enemy. Right? Haman is the one who has decreed to kill the Jews. Why are you inviting him to your party? She's going to expose him eventually, but she's also playing on Ahasuerus' insecurity. Why is the queen so close with Haman? This is very strange. There are lots of benefits to inviting him, but I think that's a key element. And you have this subplot that develops. Haman's personal threat against Mordecai. Haman already didn't like Mordecai in chapter 3. That was how he ended up with the decree against the Jews in the first place. But now it's personal. He wants Mordecai to have his own execution. That's what he's looking for. But there's a 3-day fast. The Jews pray to God. And from here, things change. So, that brings us to chapter 6. Chapter 6, the reward for Mordecai and the downfall for Haman begin. Ahasuerus can't sleep. He calls his, whoever they are, readers, and they're going to read him the Chronicles of the Kingdom. Because, again, that's what you do with your version of Chronicles, and you read them or you write them. So, they find Mordecai's unrewarded rescue of the king. Ahasuerus asks, who's outside? It's Haman, who has come to get permission to hang Mordecai. Bring him in. Haman comes in, and Ahasuerus says, you know, there's somebody I really want to reward. What should I do for him? And Haman says to himself, gotta be me, right? Who else would the king want to reward? Why? Because he knows the king is afraid of everybody else. Of course it has to be him. It makes perfect sense that it's going to be him. Who else could it possibly be? And so he says, remarkably, I'll tell you what I think you ought to do. Oh, I skipped some of the text in number 9. That's my problem. I'll put it on the next page. All right, that's about the Jews being different. We're not going to worry about it right now. But take a look at number 10, please. Look at this text. That night the king's sleep was shaken. He set free the book of records, the accounts of the days, and they were read before the king. And it was found recorded that Mordecai had told the Bigthan and Teresh, two royal officers from the guards of the door who had sought to set their hand against King Ahasuerus. And the king asked, what was done? What glory and greatness for Mordecai for this? And the king's youths, his servants, said nothing was done for him. And the king says, who's in the yard? And Haman had come to the yard, because he wanted to get Mordecai killed. So Haman says to the king, for the man that the king wishes to honor, let them bring royal garb, which the king has worn, and the horse the king has ridden, and which has the royal crown upon his head. And let the garb and the horse be given to a man from the king's officers, depart from him, and let them dress the man whom the king wishes to honor, and ride him on the horse in the city street, and let them declare before him, so shall be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor. Tell me, is that a smart thing to say to the king? I think we should take your horse and your royal garb and a crown, right? And bring this man through the streets. Dude. What are you thinking? You were smart just a couple of chapters ago. You were smart. Why did you think that was a good idea? And Ahasuerus says to Haman, take the garb, take the horse as you've spoken, and do this for Mordecai. That's a really remarkable thing. Of course, as the chapter ends, that's what Haman has to do. And then he goes home very angry, miserable. But there's a lot going on here, and because time is short, I'm going to say it rather than play it out as a dialogue. But first of all, why can't Ahasuerus sleep? Why is he unable to sleep? So you can see it very simply. Again, he is a man who lives in fear, right? However, the Talmud plays it up and says, God couldn't sleep. Source number 11. When it says, in the Hebrew, Balayla ha'huna v'dash nat ha'melech, the way that the Talmud reads that is literally that night the king's sleep was disturbed, but it's read it as melech with a capital M, so to speak. King with a capital K. Actually, traditionally, when the Megillah is read, often that part is read extra loud, and Hamelech in that line is sometimes read the way it is on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the beginning of Shacharit, right? Where Hamelech is Hamelech, right? That's the way someone will read it there, because it's not Melech, king. Human king is the king, is God. That God, as recorded here in the Talmud, was unable to sleep, so to speak. God is the one who is moving things at this point. But Ahasuerus has them read the Chronicles, which could be an antidote for insomnia, right? Or it could be because he's looking for something. Something's bothering him, he's not sure what. So he's told that this fellow Mordechai saved your life, and he says, what was done for him? And the answer is, nothing. And what does he say? Who's in the yard? Why does he ask who's in the yard? Why does he ask who's in the yard? He's afraid someone's lurking outside the room. Right? Who is outside? Have the guards check the perimeter. That's what he's asking. Who's outside? And lo and behold, who's outside? Oh, just Haman. In the middle of the night. Very dedicated worker. The Haman is hanging out outside of the throne room. The same one who was invited to the party with Esther. Huh. That's interesting. Take a look at source number 12. Talmud reads in, a thought fell into his mind, Ahasuerus' mind. He said, what is this that Esther invited Haman? Perhaps they're taking counsel against that man. It's a euphemism. It means against me. To kill him. Then he said, if so, isn't there anyone who likes me who would tell me? Wouldn't someone warn me if there was a plot? And then he said, perhaps there's someone who benefited me and I didn't pay him back. And so people refrain from revealing this to me. And that's when he has the Chronicles read. And then he finds out Haman, the very same one who was invited to the party, is actually lurking in the middle of the night outside of the throne room. And so he plays a game. It's a test for Haman. He doesn't say, I want to honor Mordechai. He says, imagine the following scenario. There was somebody I wanted to honor. And Haman fails the test abysmally. And the king sees it. And he responds in two ways. First of all, he gives Mordechai the honor. He knows Haman doesn't like Mordechai. But notice what he omitted. In number 10, he skips something. Give him the royal guard. Give him the royal horse. No crown. There are other ways you can read that text, but I think he's actually omitting the crown. That's number one. But number two, Haman himself, the king's second in command, is going to be the one to parade him through the streets. You don't think he's making a point? Of course he's making a point. And then you get to chapter 7 and 8. So the second party, Esther tells Ahasuerus, Haman is the one who wants to kill my people. Haman pleads with Esther. Ahasuerus comes back in from being outside where he's gone for a walk. And Haman is pleading for his life from Esther. Ahasuerus thinks that something else is going on here. He comes back into the room, and Haman is on the bed that Esther is sitting on. That's a remarkably bad move. That takes skill. And then, a gentleman by the name of Carbona, who happens to work for the king, happens to mention, you know, that Mordechai you like so much? There's a really tall tree in Haman's backyard. And it's set up to hang Mordechai. Wouldn't you know? And Ahasuerus says, that's a fine place to get rid of Haman. That's what happens. That's your story. Take a look at source number 13, please. Look at the way that the Talmud portrays what happens after Esther tells Ahasuerus about Haman. As the king rose in his anger from the feast of wine to the royal garden, he goes out and says, I gotta clear my head. Why does he need to clear his head and not act immediately? He's not a king who thinks and says, you know what, let me pause and take time. He's confused. Because he thought, no, he might be drunk also. But he's confused. Because until now, he thought Haman and Esther were out to the garden to clear his head. And the king returns, still number 13, the king returned from the royal garden to the feast of wine. Just as he rose in anger, so he returned in anger. Meaning the anger didn't dissipate. For he went and found the ministering malachim, angels, in the guise of men, uprooting the trees of the orchard. This is again another piece of the Talmud seeing God's hand in sustaining Ahasuerus' insecurity and anger. He said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Oh, Haman instructed us. Haman told us to uproot the trees from your orchard in order to get the tree that we're going to use to hang Mordecai." He entered the palace. Haman was falling on the bed on which Esther was seated. That's what the text says. Falling, the Talmud asks. Shouldn't it say fell? He had already fallen? Rabbi Elazar said this teaches that an angel, a malach, came and knocked him onto the bed. In other words, God is moving things forward. That's the idea. Okay, so Esther sprung the trap. Ahasuerus walks out. And he comes back in, and he finds Haman on Esther's bed, and then Harbona speaks up, and he says, yeah, you know, he wants to kill Mordecai. Harbona's work is so perfect, because he's uniting two plot lines. He's uniting, on the one hand, Ahasuerus' suspicion of Haman as somebody who might be rebelling against him, as well as the fact that Mordecai wasn't rewarded for what he did, which now Haman is going to attack Mordecai. He's uniting those two elements by saying, yeah, Haman, who you think might be a bad guy, is not only plotting against Esther the queen, he's also plotting against the man who saved your life. And all the elements converge. And his timing is so perfect that take a look at the last source, number 14. It says, Harbona is not Harbona. Harbona is actually Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, showing up on the scene. Because he's just too perfect. It just fits too well that there's somebody in the Persian court who's on our side, who is willing to say this and put pain, so to speak, to everything. It's really remarkable. One last piece demonstrates Ahasuerus' insecurity, but also his selfishness, and that's chapter 8. In chapter 8, Esther goes to Ahasuerus and says, thank you so much for killing Haman, but we still have a problem, because you still issued a decree that everybody can attack the Jews. What are we going to do about that? And Ahasuerus says, well, I can't take back my order. Is there any issue? He says, it's not me. This is the way things work in the Persian Empire. Which is not so clear. When you read about other decrees of the Persian Empire in the book of Ezra, it's not so clear that this is true. But whatever. I'm not sure. I can't back down. Right? I issued my decree. That's what has to happen. This piece of things, that the Jews are still in danger, speaks to Ahasuerus' focus on himself. I got rid of Haman. There's no more threat to me. Right? No word on who's in Haman's place at this point. Mordecai ends up being there. But he says, I can't take it back now. I'm fine. So the Jews will burn. That's the way it goes. And it takes Esther pleading to get a decree that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. Ahasuerus remains who he was all along. Someone who was concerned about himself, someone who was afraid of being attacked, and he's so insecure that at times will even act against his own best interests. And that's the story from the beginning, with his parties, all the way to the end, with his inability to retract his decree. It's all one big psychological drama, invisibly driven by God's hand. And the Talmud tries to bring certain elements to the fore to demonstrate God's involvement, but visibly driven by Ahasuerus' insecurity and selfishness, as well as Haman's greed. There is so much more to be said about this book, but I hope I've given you something to work with. Thank you very much.